Andrew, the floor is yours.
Great. Thank you, Steve. And actually, before I start, I'm going to turn it over to Victoria Herman to introduce us, and then we'll get going.
Great. So thank you. Good afternoon, and welcome to our event, Arctic Strategy, 1 year into the U.S. Arctic Council Chairmanship. I'm Victoria Herman, the Managing Director of the Arctic Institute, and we would like to thank Andrew and the American Security Project for partnering with us and hosting this event today. The Arctic Institute is a global network of researchers. We have field-based researchers across North America and Eurasia in the Arctic working on many dimensions of Arctic security. So we look at climate and environmental security and its intersections with civic security, cultural security, and the more traditional security issues that we'll be discussing today. And because we look at security issues and because our name is the Arctic Institute, oftentimes we get inquiries about the new Cold War in the Arctic. So I counted just before this, and over the past 12 months, we have had 23 inquiries to discuss something related to the new Cold War. So that was really the impetus of this event, was to dig deeper than those media headlines to discuss the challenges and opportunities of circumpolar security happening today from a few different perspectives and really delve into the nuanced situations that we see across North America and Eurasia and the high north. So without further ado, I'll hand it over to Andrew, who will moderate the event, introduce our speakers, and tell us a bit more about the American Security Project.
Great. Thank you, Victoria, and thanks especially to the Arctic Institute for partnering with us and getting us going on this work. And I've worked with Victoria and her predecessor Malte for years, so it's great to we've been talking about doing something like this for years. So it's great to actually make it a reality. The American Security Project, I see a lot of familiar faces in the crowd, but some new faces as well. So if you haven't been here to our events in the past, some background about ASP. We were founded about a decade ago by then-Senators Kerry and Hagel and former Senators Hart and Rudman in order to promote a better dialogue on national security, really a nonpartisan dialogue on national security, to think about what are the threats and opportunities that our country faces over the long term, and to kind of get out of the day-to-day trench warfare on Capitol Hill. We take a range of issues, everything from nuclear non-proliferation to counterterrorism and asymmetric operations, to things like American competitiveness, and I'm the fellow for energy security and climate change. We take all of these issues, though, through the national security lens. As a fellow for energy and climate change, that led me into looking into and researching on the Arctic, because it really is a place where these, you know, energy, the last kind of the last frontier for energy resources, climate change, we care about it because the climate is changing, especially up there, so fast, and the ice is melting at unprecedented rates that it's really opening for human habitation and exploration for the first time in human history. On security, we have to think about this from a security perspective because certainly the U.S. Navy is, our allied navies, allied militaries are, and the Russian military is, thinking about it from a security perspective. So we have to look at it. And as Victoria said, we also have to, you know, avoid this idea of a new Cold War. You know, let's actually, you know, look at what the facts are and think about both what the threats and the opportunities are. So that's what we're going to try and do today. Before I introduce and turn it over to our speakers, though, I wanted to kind of set the scene a little bit. So a year and a half ago, in the lead up to U.S. taking the chairmanship of the Arctic Council, I was asked to testify before the House Committee on Foreign Relations about, you know, what the U.S. should be doing in the Arctic and the Arctic Council. And I gave five recommendations at the end, and I think it's actually useful to kind of go back and look at these to see what's happened since then. First recommendation was ratify the law, UN Law of the Sea Convention. So, no, we haven't done that. A second recommendation was increase funding for U.S. military presence by either U.S. Navy or U.S. Coast Guard. And I think there's actually some movement on that. We've seen some funding going into, obviously, into the new icebreaker, but there's also been talk and push on not drawing down forces in Alaska and that sort of stuff. So that's actually slowly moving. Three, make a final decision on whether to approve and regulate offshore oil drilling. And this was in the context at the time that, you know, we really didn't know, oil companies really didn't know whether the Obama administration was going to move forward or not. So there's still some uncertainty in that, but I think slowly moving forward with the Department of Interior rules and all that sort of stuff, bringing more certainty to that. Four, elevate Admiral Papp's role to a permanent ambassador level position. No, that hasn't happened, and I think it still should. Congressman Sensenbrenner has a bill to do that, and I think it's actually should be pretty easy to pass, but hasn't. And then five, raise the Arctic's profile by regularly participating in Arctic-focused events. And I think that's actually been the biggest thing about our chairmanship of the Arctic Council is the fact that people like Secretary of State Kerry have gone up to the Arctic and continue to go up to the Arctic. He's on his way to the Norwegian Arctic as we speak. The president went to Alaska, first president to go to the Arctic. So these things are important. So I think there has been progress in, let's count, let's say about 2.5 out of 5. So pretty good. So things are moving, but maybe there's some more things that we can be doing and should be doing. So with that, I'm going to stop talking, and we're gonna hear from our esteemed panel here, and I'll just quickly introduce them, and then we'll go from there. First will be Brigadier General Stephen Cheney. He's CEO of the American Security Project and member of the Foreign Affairs Policy Board and State Department International Security Advisory Board, and he's been actually working on a paper for the International Security Advisory Board on Arctic issues. Which will be publicly released within a month. So keep an eye on our website. We'll link to it. After him, Captain Eric Boal, Assistant Defense and Naval Attaché for the Royal Norwegian Embassy, will offer perspective on Norway's long interest in Arctic affairs. And we're pleased to have him here, and thanks to the Norwegian Embassy for partnering with us on this. And then finally, Seth Myers is a fellow at the Arctic Institute and has worked at a series of think tanks on security issues, and he'll discuss developments in the regional security considerations throughout it. So we're going to try and keep a relatively short for each of them, and so we'll have time for questions from the audience. So be thinking of good ones and call us on that. So thank you, and General Cheney, over to you.
Andrew, thank you. Full disclosure, I hate to disappoint you, but I am not an Arctic expert. But that said, I've spent the better part of the last year and a half with the International Security Advisory Board on their Arctic Study Group, and the terms of reference, which are all public, were given to us by Rose Gottmiller, who's the Undersecretary of State for Arms Control and International Security. And part of the focus of those terms of reference, and I won't read them all here, but the major focus is Russia. And a lot of that, of course, is security related. Now, I know we build today's event as 1 year into our chairmanship of the Arctic Council, which it is. And, of course, Secretary Kerry is the current chair. We've got one more year left to go. Admiral Papp is our senior representative assigned to it, and I'll talk a little bit about that. But as many in this audience are aware, by its own precepts, the Arctic Council does not discuss or consider security considerations. And, of course, that's kind of my focus, and under the ISAB, that's been what I've been tasked to look at. And I come from a long-storied Marine career, but my involvement in foreign relations started with the Council on Foreign Relations in 93 and 94 as a military fellow, and I've kept that up. And I bring that up today, too, because The Council on Foreign Relations has its own study group now, task force just commissioned 2 weeks ago on the Arctic, chaired by Thad Allen and Christine Todd Whitman. I'm on that group as well. And we've heard from all the normal players, and not the least of which are Admiral Papp and Mark Brzezinski. Now, on June 9th, they held an event at the CFR with those two and Senator Murkowski. If you've not seen it, you can Google it. It's on YouTube. It was a public event. So I'm not going to regurgitate everything they said at that particular event. Mark and the Admiral detailed quite a bit exactly what they've done, and of course what Mark does. He's the executive director, if you will, of all the Arctic entities and the government. That's a good thing, and he's done a lot of really positive things, I think, in raising the profile of the Arctic in our own government and in the United States and in the world. And they've done good work. Can they do more? Can they do better? Perhaps. Even Secretary Kerry himself has said he thinks they can do a lot more. And he's working on that. And, of course, he is very, very active. He's been up to the Arctic many, many times. And, of course, he's going up there today as we speak. When you pull up their own website, the Arctic Council, you'll see a number of things that they listed as highlights and what they think they ought to be doing. Among them are promoting Arctic Ocean safety, security, and stewardship. I think they've done that and are doing that. Improving economic and living conditions in the region. Not so sure on that one. Addressing the impacts of climate change. And when you listen to Senator Murkowski 2 weeks ago, she said the spring this year in Alaska was 8 degrees warmer than it's ever been. They had to truck in snow for the Iditarod. Their climate change is having a dramatic impact in the world, of course, but certainly in the Arctic. And I used to say Bangladesh was the poster child for climate change and sea level rise, but I think it's the Arctic now, and you see that constantly. Then lastly, it was Arctic awareness, and they were supposed to, the Arctic Council, raise awareness of the Arctic and its role in global ocean and climate systems. And I think they're doing that, and they're doing that well. So part of our focus here at ASP is to highlight these issues, and especially when we know there's an administration change coming, keep this issue forefront and keep it in the minds of those on Capitol Hill and the legislators to recognize that it's an important issue. It's going to affect everybody sitting in this room. As somebody once said, our refrigerators are the Arctic and Antarctic, and they're melting, and it's going to change our entire environment. And indeed it will. That said, I spent Monday night with 9 chiefs of staff of the Senate, and we talked Arctic issues. It was a split group, both Republican and Democrat, but all had a very big interest. Of course, Senator Sullivan's chief of staff was in there from Alaska. They have a great concern. Let me talk for a second or two about the security situation. And Victoria, when you said the new Cold War in the Arctic, geez, I really don't like that term. Because a lot of people think that there's this humongous land grab, and the Russians planted a flag under the North Pole, and they're stealing territories, and everybody's drilling like crazy, and that's far, far from the truth. It's one of the better regulated areas in the world. It's one of the ones that's most cooperation in the world. As Andrew mentioned, a lot of the seabed is governed by UNCLOS, the UN Convention on Law of the Sea, which our Congress will not pass this year, according to Senator Murkowski, and who knows in the upcoming years. But because we're not a signatory to it, perhaps the only non-signatory, we don't have a place at the table. The Russians have put in land requests to extend their economic exclusion zone several times. I think they're up to number 3 now, most recent being last August. All legal. All their requests are done under the auspices of UNCLOS. Denmark has done the same thing. But we have no say in the matter. We are, I guess you would say, an observer to UNCLOS, if anything else, and we take a back seat to it. So I think that is something that really has to be addressed and we ought to be looking at. Another thing, we also build this as the ISAB's coming out with a report, and we hope to have that report here today. The State Department's wheels grind slow sometimes. And we've been working on this since April of last year. We're down to a final draft. I cannot publicly tell you what the recommendations are going to be, but I can tell you some of the ones that I'm going to recommend, and I would highly expect they'll be in there. I think July 12th we'll have it completed, and we'll have it out to the press here probably July 15th or so. Many recommendations in there. Sherry Goodman's on it with me. Lester Lyles chairs of my particular group. Top of the list, of course, was UNCLOS, recommending that we be a signatory to UNCLOS. And then we get into the icebreaker issue, which I'm sure most of you in here are interested in. And there's been a big success on the icebreaker side of the House this last week. Senate Appropriations is going to appropriate $1 billion for a new Coast Guard icebreaker, which is a good thing. The bad thing is it's 10 years away. And we really have one, count them, one heavy icebreaker right now that's functional. The Russians have, give or take, 40 icebreakers. About half of those are medium to heavy. They're building new ones several a year now. But it's not really fair to compare them to us because they're 50% plus of the Arctic coastline. We're what, 10% maybe, if that? We're not really in the same ballpark. And I also hate to say, people will say, well, we've got to have a quid pro quo here. If they're building more, we need to build more. The reason we need to build more is because we are so ill-prepared for the disaster response and rescue in the Arctic. When this Celebrity, what's the ship?
Crystal Cruise.
Crystal Celebrity, yeah, goes through the Northwest Passage in August. If they have an accident, there's really nothing we can do. There is nothing we can do. If they hit an iceberg or hit an uncharted pinnacle underneath and go down, we can't respond. I mean, we can't get there. We don't have the forces. We can't do anything about it. And my point to that is, as the Northern Sea Route and Northwest Passage now becomes more passable because of climate change and melting, you're going to see more shipborne traffic. And we are not prepared to respond to any kind of catastrophe up there. And, of course, that includes any kind of oil catastrophe or any other natural disaster that happens up there. And I know that senators from Alaska feel deeply about this. One is not enough. Even one, building one new icebreaker is not enough. We probably need three or four. In some cases, they say six. In an interesting conversation I had with the Vice Commandant of the Coast Guard 3 weeks ago, I suppose, Vice Admiral Michelle, we talked about the icebreaker issue. And he said something to me that really struck home, and I asked him if I could quote him, and he said, sure. Because the Arctic is melting, we have a greater requirement for icebreakers in the north. And you kind of go, well, why would we need that? There's more water. There's more icebergs. As it melts, they're going to be more free-floating, and they're going to be more up there, and you need more ability to clear them away or to have search and rescue, which I kind of thought was another very, very interesting point. And lastly, I'll close on the security side of the house. When you talk security to the Arctic Council, well, you don't talk to security to the Arctic Council. They wave at you and go, we are a scientific-based research organization here, and we are precepted from not discussing the security issues that are involved here. I believe there ought to be a mechanism to talk security with all eight Arctic nations, obviously including Russia. What's gone on in Crimea and Ukraine and our new sanctions against them and the severing of most military-to-military relations with Russia, we've got no venue to talk to them about what's going on in the Arctic. Now, it's no surprise that they have dramatically, over the last 10 years, increased the positioning and are building their forces greatly in the Arctic. Most of it's around Murmansk, but not all of it. And what they will tell you is, because 20% of their GDP comes from the Arctic, that they're protecting the resources, and with the opening of the Northern Sea Route, they want to protect those ships that are passing through, as well as tax them and use it as a source of revenue. There is no aggressive, offensive military capability associated with the forces put up there. I'm not sure that's particularly the case, but that also said, a majority of their ballistic missile submarines are stationed in Murmansk, and that's a national asset to them, and they want to protect that, and that's clearly understandable. I think we shouldn't do anything to threaten that. Often I'm told, let's position more forces in Alaska, and I kind of go, what for? If they're there for disaster response and relief, it's a good thing. If they're there for cold weather training, that's a good thing too. If they're there to counter the Russians, in my opinion, that's a bad thing. We don't want to aggravate that situation whatsoever. So lastly, I'll close when I talked about having a mechanism to talk to Russia on the security side. Some say, well, NATO can do that. You mentioned NATO and Russia in the same sentence, and the Russians tear their hair out. That's not going to work. So there ought to be some kind of a organization, perhaps similar to the Arctic Council, which has all eight countries, but talks security. And my recommendation, and it falls in line with Heather Connolly's, is having something along the lines of the Organization of Security and Cooperation for Europe, OSCE-type model, where you could create a new organization and have it address security concerns across the board. And it's not hard to do. There's a model there and it can be done. And I've got some interest on that side, Congress, and I know, Seth, you're probably going to talk a little bit about this. So that's where I'm coming from on all this. I appreciate everybody being here. I think the Arctic Council is doing a good job. Can they do more? Sure. We need to keep this issue highlighted. We need to keep it forefront, especially through November, December this year and into the next administration. With that, I'll turn it over to the good captain.
Captain Bo, over to you.
Thank you. First of all, I'm not an expert on the Arctic, but I've been there many, many times, both on the surface and subsurface, so it is a unique area. But for the next minutes, I will focus on the Arctic, but also our portion of the Arctic. And talking about the Arctic, we always have to talk about Russia, so I always do that. But the uniqueness about the Norwegian Arctic is that most of it is free of ice. And the infrastructure and the mainland of Norway and the island of Svalbard is highly developed. We have about 500,000 people living up there, which is 10% of the population of Norway. And I'm making a point out of this because if compared to the global Arctic, the Norwegian Arctic is in many ways different, though many of the concerns and the challenges are the same. Remember, our Arctic starts with a latitude of 66 degrees, roughly, and over here, the Arctic starts further south. As expressed by the Norwegian Minister of Foreign Affairs, the Arctic is Norway's priority with regards to our foreign policy. It is in everyone's interest that Arctic remains a peaceful and stable region, and that everyone complies, again, with the law of the seas, and the established management regimes. International cooperation in the north, not least with Russia, has produced good results in areas such as maritime safety, joint fisheries management, and people-to-people cooperation. According to the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, the Arctic represents a global cooling system, and it holds back 7 meters of sea level rise in its ice caps. And with temperatures in the Arctic currently rising twice as fast as the global average, the ice and snow is melting at a record pace. And 2016 seems to be another record year. So let us be clear, the melting of the Arctic is a threat to far more than traditional livelihoods and polar bears. Arctic warming is amplifying and accelerating global warming, which is causing unprecedented damage to our planet. Hence, a strong call for the world to take action. So climate change is no longer something only our children and grandchildren will experience. It is actually happening now, here and now. It is already having wide-reaching implications for top priority foreign policy areas such as trade, mass migration, humanitarian assistance, conflict prevention, and security. So due to its scale, speed, and unpredictability, climate change is rightly described as the ultimate threat multiplier, and we must deal with it for what it is, a major global security threat. Because of Norway's interests and responsibilities in the Arctic, it is essential for us to maintain presence in the region and protect our rights and fulfill our obligations. Norway is therefore increasing the armed forces' presence at sea and enhancing their monitoring capacity. There is an increasing interest for the Arctic. However, there is no race towards the Arctic. Yes, we are seeing an increase in commercial activity, trade, and technological innovation in the Arctic. But remember, for humans, this is almost a no man's land. So then over to Russia. Is Russia unpredictable? Is Russia kind of a black box, a political entity not possible to understand, or a mystery cannot be solved? I will argue that we do know a lot with regards to the drivers in Russian politics, their goals, the ways and means, the instruments, at least regarding foreign and security policy. It is predictable that Russia would like to dominate the earlier Soviet areas, the satellite states, that they will protect Russian interests and Russian citizens. The fact that Russia was willing to use military power to prevent an Ukrainian EU integration was a surprise for many. However, Russia's wish not to be challenged in the neighborhood had been stated for 15 years. It is predictable that Russia is, what we may call it, paranoid with regards to own security and NATO. We mean that NATO does not threaten Russia. They mean NATO's politics, especially NATO's expansion and their increase of military capabilities in East Europe, does threaten Russian security. Another thing, being a little provocative again, in April this year, Russian fighters in the Baltic harassed an American Navy ship, USS Donald Cook. It was dangerous, it was wrong, and unjustifiable. But maybe not unpredictable. They have for a long time warned us about their ability and willingness to counter any European missile defense near Russian territories, of which they claim the USS Donald Cook is a part of. It is also predictable that Russian utilize all their instruments to get what they want. The last years they have, and still do, improve their military capabilities and their ability to make quick decisions and coordinate the instruments of power, as demonstrated in Ukraine and Syria. A lot of Russian politics is predictable, but there is also a lot of uncertainties. For instance, the degree of revisionism in Russian foreign politics. They are not happy with NATO's expansion. But does that mean that they intend to change the fact that the Baltic states have been a NATO member for 10 years? Does Russia have the will to confront NATO militarily? They have military concept and capacities, but it does not mean they intend to confront a military superior opponent. But it worries. What is President Putin's rationale for doing what he is doing? Is he a genius? Or is he, in lack of a better word, mad? All the time, he is in charge of politics, which we in the West do not understand, while he tends to be unpredictable. We have to live with a Russia that can surprise us, but it should be possible to mitigate the consequences of what is unpredictable and exploit what's predictable. All our experience with Russia says that they do not want a confrontation, not with NATO, not with us in Norway. At the same time, they are dissatisfied with parts of our politics. And today's political climate gives room for misunderstandings. Russia has the ability to exploit windows of opportunity and plenty of political and military instruments to affect an opponent. So if they want to put pressure on NATO or Norway, they will use all available means in a modern conflict, talking about information operations, cyber operations, paramilitary, insurgency operations, all difficult to handle unless you want to end up escalating the situation. They, as nobody else, as anybody else, will make sure that they are not the aggressive part. So our knowledge about our neighbor in the East tells us that they have the ability to challenge us, not only militarily. In Norway, we have different entities with a lot of knowledge about Russia. To call Russia unpredictable does not give any added value. It more points back at us being inadequate. We know Russia better than that, and they know us. And we have to utilize our knowledge to communicate and implement realistic and robust politics, as we have done for decades. Russia's violations of the international law in Ukraine have affected also our relations. In response to Russia's unacceptable actions, Norway has suspended its military cooperation with Russia and also postponed a number of political relations. At the same time, our shared geography and border makes it necessary to work together on a number of issues, issues like search and rescue, managing shared fish stocks, environmental protection, nuclear safety, maritime safety, as well as Coast Guard and Border Guard activities. In order to avoid any misunderstandings, we also have an open line between the Norwegian Joint Operational Headquarters and the Northern Fleet. We see no direct threat to Norwegian sovereignty in the north today. Looking at the map from a polar projection, we see that about 50% of the circumpolar areas are Russian. Hence, Russia clearly has legitimate interests in this area. Having said that, we must, of course, consider the new security landscape in Europe. A new normal has been introduced, which strongly affects how we address our security and defense policy. Thank you so much.
Captain Bo, thank you. Over to you, Seth.
All right, excellent. Thank you. Sonia. Great, so I'm just gonna give a brief overview of sort of what I see as the security environment in the region and try and offer a bit of a historical perspective, and then very briefly touch upon possibilities for US leadership, which I think General Cheney has already spoken to better and more eloquently than I can, so I'll just go very briefly on that. When looking at the Arctic from a security perspective, I think it's important that one look not just intra-regionally, but extra-regionally as well. And I say that because despite a lot of attempts, mostly by the press, to be fair, as my colleague Victoria touched upon, to build up the notion of a new Cold War, drum roll, or a fight over Arctic resources, or sort of a battle royale over undefined borders, I tend to agree with the vast majority of Arctic experts on this, in that this is not likely. It's not feasible. It's unrealistic. There's simply no reason for anyone to engage in it in the near to medium to somewhat long term. So I believe that, in fact, the Arctic is far more threatened by events outside the region than events in it. I think it is prone to the concept of what we call strategic spillover. And there's a tendency to look back at the last quarter century and declare the Arctic a peaceful region, a region of laws, a highly governed region, the most governed region in the world, et cetera, et cetera. However, the last 20 years, from a perspective of great power, conflict, and competition, have actually been abnormally peaceful compared to most of history. You really have to go back to the period between the Crimean War and the outbreak of World War I to find sort of an analogous period in history. And I would contend that the Arctic just reflects that. And that, I contend, is the crux of the Arctic security environment. It tends to reflect the international system writ large. And to quickly clarify, I say that in regard to great power politics. I'm not speaking in terms of the so-called small wars, irregular warfare, guerrilla warfare, terrorism. That obviously is not taking place in the Arctic. And while those are devastating and horrible and can be very destabilizing on a regional and certainly within a country aspect, they tend not to disrupt the international system to the same extent that great power competition does. So I would posit that if we just look back throughout history, we'll see that usually what's going on in the rest of the world is in fact what's going on in the Arctic. If we go back about 100 years ago from today to 1917, it was, of course, the middle of World War I, and the USA was landing Marines in the Russian Arctic in an attempt to intervene and put down the Bolsheviks in the Russian Civil War. In 1940, as the Nazi war machine rolled seemingly unstoppable across Europe, Buda in the Norwegian Arctic was being devastated by the Luftwaffe as Germany advanced into Norway. 3 years later, the tide of the war had begun to turn. The Nazi war machine had been stopped. Allied forces were beginning to roll back German advances. And if we look to Buda in 1943, we find Operation Leader, in which German shipping and Norwegian shipping under German control was in turn decimated by Allied air attacks. Throughout World War II, post-Operation Barbarossa, there were Arctic convoys resupplying the USSR. They were dangerous. There were quite a number of medals won on them. It was horrible, but that was the best way to resupply the USSR, and the Arctic was not immune to what was going on in the rest of the world. In the Cold War, as with the rest of the world, NATO-Soviet relations were not actively fighting each other, but US and Soviet subs were playing cat and mouse under the polar ice, feeling each other out, finding potential launch points for ICBMs. NATO was running U-2 missions, again out of Buda Air Base. The famous U-2 that was shot down was actually launched from Buda. The distant early warning line was built across the Canadian Arctic. So again, you see a reflection of what was happening in the international system happening in the Arctic. And some academics would actually cite, if you're looking for the beginning of sort of the current era of Arctic relations, this era of cooperation and stability and peace, a number of academics point to a specific moment in which Gorbachev gave a speech in Murmansk in 1987. In other words, as perestroika was taking hold, so too was reform and change coming to the Arctic. Now, as discussed, the region has been largely peaceful and cooperative for the last 25 years, as has the international system in general. However, we are beginning to see changes in that system. I would contend that Russia at this point can be fairly described as a revisionist power that is trying to roll back. I agree with Captain Bo that they're not looking for an actual fight with NATO, but I do think it's fair to say they're trying to roll back NATO and EU influence on its borders and to remake the international system in such a manner as to maximize its own power and reduce the influence of American power. We see this to a lesser extent with China. Their intentions, I would argue, are less clear than Russia. But again, we're starting to see a shift in the international system away from the unipolar moment, so to speak. And accordingly, you're seeing signs of this in the Arctic. I think we're starting to see signs of this strategic spillover. There's been the cancellation of mil-mil exercises between NATO nations and Russia. Northern Eagle was canceled after Western sanctions took hold. Vigilant Skies has not happened since 2013. These were exercises between, in the former case, it was going to be Norway, the U.S., and Russia. In the latter case, it was the United States and Russia. We've seen an active Russian remilitarization of the Arctic, setting up a series of bases, including everything from search and rescue stations along the northern sea route, which, as Captain Bo alluded to, you cannot argue with the legitimacy of, to airfields and air defense radar stations. We've seen the Northern Fleet practicing aquatic landings on Arctic islands. So, you know, again, difficult to tell what exactly is going on there, but it's not all purely defense of the status quo, shall we say. There's been a significant increase in the number of NATO intercepts of Russian aircraft in the region. Captain Bo touched upon the most recent example of Russian air forces harassing a ship in the Baltic. And we've seen Western sanctions that are targeting Russia over what's going on in the Ukraine specifically affect economic development in the Arctic. We've seen sanctions target specific companies that are working on developing the energy infrastructure in the region. Now, again, the topic of this event is American leadership, so I want to briefly touch on that because I do think there's a unique opportunity that may exist to address some of the aforementioned issues. Generally speaking, as General Cheney alluded to, the concept of military security in the Arctic has been controversial and almost verboten amongst some, you might say. You know, the Arctic Council is prevented from talking about it. And generally speaking, most experts, most academics, and most foreign ministries seem to dislike even bringing it up because they argue there's no need of it. It's been peaceful. It's been stable for 25 years. Why would you rock the boat? However, within the last month, the government of Denmark conducted a review of its foreign policy in which it acknowledged the increasing complexity of the security environment in the Arctic and recommended either allowing the Arctic Council to talk about military security or creating a new body in which that could be discussed. People have sort of latched on to the latter as the notion of a potential Arctic security forum, if you will, in which these issues could be addressed. I see this as an opportunity, and perhaps the best that we will have, at least in the near term, for the USA to engage in some genuine regional leadership and take advantage of the sort of diplomatic cover that Denmark has provided us, if you will, by raising this issue and by acknowledging the potential utility of such an organization to move forward with this suggestion. I think that we owe it to ourselves and to the world to at least test the waters, see if it's feasible, see if it's possible, see if it can be done. Personally, I don't recommend, I agree with General Cheney, I don't recommend securitizing the Arctic Council. I think it's done a good job thus far with its mandate. And while I suppose I'm recommending rocking the boat on a macro level, I don't see any reason to do that organizationally. But I think that we can build upon some existing structures, be it the Arctic Coast Guard Forum that has continued to meet despite sanctions against Russia, some of the other mil-mil engagement that's been done bilaterally. I think there's an opportunity, and I think that the time to do it is now. You know, people say, well, there's no need, don't rock the boat. It's a very peaceful situation right now. It's highly governed. It's stable. Well, that's when you want to build a security architecture. You don't want to wait until everything has gone haywire and then try and set up the rules of the road. The idea is you set up the rules of the road to prevent things from ever getting to that point in the first place. So just to kind of, you know, quickly conclude, as I said, I would argue that the Arctic has generally reflected the international system, and the international system is growing in complexity, and the dangers in the international system are growing, and we're starting to see this spill over into the Arctic. We have a unique opportunity right now to perhaps head off some of that instability that could be coming and take advantage of the current stability and the current governance to deal with some of these challenges before they become firmly entrenched.
Our speakers, and I'm going to take moderator's privilege to ask kind of we were a little bit deliberately provocative, and I think that's good, and I'm maybe going to be that as well. I guess I've had, when I've taken these same press calls that Victoria talked about, kind of the answer is so what? What do you expect to happen? And I think Seth did a good job of outlining that, yes, now it's peaceful, but we have this bias that what's happening now is what's always been and what's always will be. And I think it was very important to show that that's actually not the case. Maybe I'll show kind of what I think is so what and you know why we should do this now and why we worry about this. I've kind of answered that question a couple of times in saying, well, look at China and the South China Sea right now, and the issues going over borders and over kind of this persistent militarization of some of these shoals and building up bases and stuff like that, and that if we don't act now to kind of keep this peace, maybe there's a threat that we could see similar destabilizations in 10, 20, 30 years in the Arctic. Now, I'll ask Seth here, what do you think on that, and then open it to the other panel. Is that the danger, or is it something else? You know, what are we trying to stop?
Well, I mean, at a most basic level, again, I'm sort of going to default back to my initial statement, which is you're trying to do the same thing you are generally in the international system, which is prevent war. You know, that's worst case scenario, obviously. And then from there, you kind of climb down the ladder and try and prevent everything that leads up to it as best you can. You know, the difference being that we have in a lot of the rest of the world regional organizations that, you know, work towards preventing that. And so, you know, I think on a most basic level, really what you're trying to do is sort of maintain the way things are, right? I mean, things have worked pretty well to this point, but I would also contend that they've not really been challenged. You know, as I said, the international system has been very peaceful, so there's not been a lot of challenge there. The other thing that I'll say, since we're being provocative, is that, you know, people point to the Arctic Council as proof of stability and proof of this, you know, great success, and everyone gets along and agrees, and it's immune from what's going on in the rest of the world. As we've discussed, the Arctic Council is prohibited from talking about security.
Right.
So, you know, I would contend, and I'm not trying to denigrate the Arctic Council, I do think they do good work, but to say that success is avoiding the difficult topics and then issuing non-binding resolutions on the ones we all agree upon is a pretty low bar, and I think we can do better than that, quite frankly. I think that, you know, while times are good, that's when you bring up the hard subjects. And you work to create trust, you work to create, you know, general agreement and principles about how the region is going to be, and hopefully you actually can then insulate it from the rest of the world. That's TBD, but I think that's the goal, ultimately.
Captain Bo, what does Norway see? I mean, you talk about you all do know Russia, and what does Norway see as kind of the, what is the threat that we're trying to prevent here? What's the future that we don't want to happen?
We have the this kind of the relationship with Russia. I mean, we have never been to war with Russia, never. We have about 121 miles of border together with them. If you ask people in Southern Europe how they feel about Russia, you will have one answer. If you ask people about this, ask the same question in South Norway, you will have another one. And if you ask people up in Northern Norway about Russia, they don't know what you're talking about, because people-to-people relationship up there is as it should be. Not many, I think, personal opinion, not many people are kind of worried. We have capped the 4 to 5 most important kind of lines of operations with Russia, which we think is important. We have stopped the kind of the military thing between our two nations. But everything that has to do with search and rescue and maritime security in general and Coast Guard and border control, everything is as it was last year or 2 or 3 years ago. So I think what we would like to do in the future and see happens is that we should continue to communicate. And I think that's probably one of the most important things, that we talk together. Because if you stop doing that, kind of that's probably the most dangerous thing.
Yeah. Andrew, I the hair on the back of my neck goes up a little bit when you start to compare what China's doing in the South China Sea to what the Russians are doing in the Arctic. And the insinuation sometimes that there's this massive, or there's a land grab and people are rushing, we're going to take out territory. Not so in the Arctic.
Right.
They've put in an UNCLOS request to extend the economic exclusion zone. It's an extension of their own continental shelf. It may or may not be approved.
Yeah.
China, on the other hand,
is
building islands out of shoals, planting a flag on it, saying it's our territorial waters now, and they're now trying to put in requests too. But they've already said, even if they put in a request to legally get it established and it's turned down, which it probably will be, they're not going to abide by that anyway.
Right.
And plus that, it's thousands of miles away from mainland China here. And so it's clearly a provocation. It threatens many of the countries in the South China Sea.
Yeah.
And then you get into the freedom of navigation side of the house, which we've exercised those rights in the South China Sea. I don't see us doing freedom of navigation in the Russian Arctic.
Right.
Just don't see it.
Right.
Now, that said, we have an argument with Canada, and we are still arguing with Canada over an UNCLOS request and who has rights over Bering Strait and territorial waters. And one of our recommendations, I think, is going to come out of the ISAP is, wouldn't you think our closest neighbor, we'd be able to figure that one out? So it's interesting. I think we have more arguments on this side of the house with Canada than we do with Russia.
Right. I agree. With that, I'll open it up to questions, and I'll give it to Caitlin first.
Thank you very much, and thank you all for coming. First, I've put in the good word for UNCLOS.
Yeah, Caitlin, you do great work.
Depending how the election comes up, it could end up as the first thing on the agenda, because if Hillary Clinton wins and the Senate becomes favorable, she's been through it before.
And good
she's
to be optimistic.
So I don't know what the odds are, but I have my hopes. To me, one of the most important things in dealing with the Arctic, because it is too big for any country, as you said, even Russia, to manage on its own, is to make it easier to cooperate in areas of joint interest. Part of that is simply knowing what's going on, maritime domain awareness. And how do we share resources? It's a lot harder to put a satellite and keep it above the Arctic than it is to put it in the tropical regions. Communications, GPS, monitoring ship traffic on AIS. All of these things require cooperative work and enforcement even more, because if you go in someone else's water, you've got to have their law enforcement people on your ship. What do you see a way to do this? This may be more Coast Guard and fall under the Arctic Coast Guard Forum than national security. But what do you see as ways to build that maritime domain awareness so it can be useful for not just the military, but for civilian activities?
Well, I'll start on that if you don't mind. Caitlin, you hit on a point that I didn't make earlier, and the ISAP's going to make a recommendation on the communication side. Most people weren't all that sad that Shell pulled out of the drilling business up in the Arctic, but I can tell you Alaska wasn't happy with it. And one of the tragedies of it was they had started to create a pretty significant communications network, but not now. And there are communications. You just don't go to the Arctic and pull out your cell phone and call your brother. I mean, it's not that easy. And so there is a huge communications gap up there. And that's a void that needs to be filled. And maybe that's a good area where the Arctic Council can work. It's not security per se, but it's certainly got applicability on terms of rescue and those types of operations. So there's a lot of room to maneuver on that side. I'd be interested in the captain's thoughts.
Yeah, Captain Bowe, aboard ship, how has your domain awareness been?
To be honest, I mean, the further north you get, the harder it gets. It has to do with, as you said, the loss, the lack of GPS, AIS. I mean, communication in general is pretty awful up there. So it's not easy. So I'm not the expert on that, but I mean, and it should be possible to improve the way we communicate up there. I mean, we do other kind of difficult things around here, and that should be possible as well. So that's one thing. I mean, the other thing which we need to do something with, obviously, is what we call the mapping of the seabed. That's just, I mean, it's awful. I mean, I think there's a lot of numbers out, but I mean, between 5 or 20% of the mapping is relatively okay. The rest is we don't know anything. And then you have, if you then have a lot of ships sailing around there, I mean, something will happen, and then who should come and rescue? I mean, the sort of, it's a kind of a nightmare, and that is a difficult thing. So both communication and mapping of the area is, to me, two things that we need to do something with.
Very good. Questions, sir? And wait for the microphone, and please identify yourself.
Henry Hedger, a retired government researcher at NARA. I thought I'd ask you what your feelings are on establishing bottling plants, say, in Greenland or even northern Canada or any other states that border the region. The Finns have been using icebergs in the Gulf of Bothnia for bottling plants, and I thought, considering all the ice that's there, why not put it to use before it melts? As is stated, a great deal of the ice is melting or will melt, so why let it just flow into the sea and turn into salt water when mankind can put it to some valuable use and provide a good portion of the world that has droughts or insufficient water supplies with water?
Bottling plants. And I think, too, I remember maybe it was one of the Emirates was talking about a plan to get icebergs and tow them all the way to desert regions as fresh water. Certainly, it's a huge fresh water source. Any comments on that?
I'm all for it.
All for it. I remember Churchill too had this idea for icebergs as floating aircraft carriers during the Battle of the Atlantic to use icebergs and put. He had a lot of ideas, some good, some not.
Yeah, I mean, I would just say that this sort of reflects, I guess, maybe two things. One is that there are sort of many Arctics, if you will, as far as development and infrastructure. Putting a bottling plant in northern Norway would be a very straightforward task.
Yeah.
You know, I was actually just in the Norwegian Arctic on a little island, and I was calling T-Mobile to get my, you know, data renewed because the amount of infrastructure there is, I mean, it's completely developed. It's like, you know, flying to any other part of the country. You try and do that in, you know, Barrow, Alaska, and it's a lot different. Now, of course, there isn't floating ice in the Norwegian Arctic, so it wouldn't actually work. But, you know, the Finns can do it because their high north is more developed than the North American high north. But I do think you touch upon, you know, there's a lot of, and this is not my area of expertise, but there's a lot of sort of innovative and interesting ideas for sort of a new economy in the Arctic. You know, people are looking at it as a server storage too, for example, because mm-hmm. it's cold outside, so it keeps your servers cool. So there's certainly opportunities there, I would think.
Yeah, and renewable energy and stuff like that, $9 a gallon diesel to run your generators up there. So, you know, there's ways to make the economics work on renewables. I think I saw a question here, yeah.
Hi, my name is Josh Golding. I'm an intern with the Defense Department. This is a question for Captain Bo. You said that Norway's never gone to war with Russia, but Sweden and Finland have. There seems to be a bit of a subtle drift, more so with Sweden, in terms of increased cooperation in political engagement in NATO. And Finland's an interesting case, but you see that somewhat too. How do you think how Russia will react to this, and how that might affect the somewhat fragile cooperation that exists between Norway and the rest of the region?
I would say, first of all, that Sweden has not a common border, has not a common border with Russia. Norway has and Finland has. It's three countries, as we say, all being part of the Nordic countries. But we are, when it comes to, I mean, politics and the high north, we are, my personal opinion though, different. We are facing the Atlantic, facing the Arctic, the North Pole. Sweden and Finland, not. Finland has a very long common border with Russia. And the way the Finns are dealing with Russia is totally different than the ways the Swedish are dealing with Russia. So we are different. As you said, Sweden is not part of NATO. Finland is not part of NATO. And if you ask me, you might do that afterwards, if I think there will be a NATO member, I don't think so in the near future. I said that 20 years ago, and I still don't think it will happen. Because they can, as long as, same as us, Norway, we are not part of the European Union. But we are very good at not being part of the European Union. Same with the Swedes. They are not part of NATO, but they are very, very important sort of NATO plus partner. And the same goes with Finland. So what will be interesting to see is how Sweden and Finland, how they cooperate together facing NATO and Russia at the same time.
Sir, right here.
Thank you. Jason Suslovich with Senator Dan Sullivan's office. Along the provocative nature, I think I'm going to ask one too.
Great.
And going back to the South China Sea example, I think the main concern in the Arctic is not that Russia is going to make large land claims and start building islands. I think it's general, as you talked about, it's the charging of a tax or a fee for international shipping traffic. And along those lines, is that consistent with international law? And if China were to do the same thing, instead of just requiring notification in the South China Sea of transit, if China were to start charging fees or taxes to move through the South China Sea, what would the U.S. response be, and why would that be different, or should that be different than what we would do in the Arctic?
Oh, great question. Let me first talk about the difference between innocent passage and freedom of navigation, which frequently gets confused. Innocent passage is a recognition that they're your territorial waters, but we're going to pass through your territorial waters. Freedom of navigation is, this is not your territorial waters. We have a right to go through it, and we're going through it. And that's what we've been exercising in the South China Sea, because we don't recognize that China owns those territorial islands and owns those waters. So there's a difference there. Should they decide that they own those waters and want to create a tax, put a tax on people who are passing through those waters, that would be a dramatic escalation. And you would see an international uproar, a huge international uproar with it. Now, on the Russia side of the house, as long as it's within their own territorial waters or their EEZ, even within the EEZ, you should have passage over the water over the EEZ. So it bears watching, I would say. But I think there's this perception among a lot of people that there's going to be hundreds of ships passing through there all year round, and that's not going to happen for decades. Yes, it'll be open for portions of the summer for the next couple of years, and maybe it'd be even more open over the next 10 years. But as anyone will tell you, container ships can't go through there. They're not reinforced. So it's not like this is all going to open up overnight, and the Russians are going to make a gazillion dollars charging people as they come through. I just don't believe that's the case. And plus that, it's a huge expanse that they've got up there. I mean, 50% of the Arctic land is Russian. So they will tell you they're going to use it as if the people are passing through their waters, when they want to have them pay for search and rescue and escort, and that will be part of it. And there'll be insurance costs associated with it. But I just don't see it in the context of, for instance, what you say in the South China Sea.
Yeah, I think I remember reading, and correct me if I'm wrong, that they it's they don't call it a tax. They call it a charge for
a
for search a fee for search and rescue and an icebreaker capability and this sort of stuff. And, but I guess a point of clarification is along the Northern Sea Route, do they consider it and do we consider it an interior passageway? What's the term? I think Caitlin knows these very well.
Territorial waters?
Is it territorial waters? Is it an international strait?
Article 154 of the convention gives a state the right in its ice-covered EEZ, if it's ice-covered most of the year, to set its own rules, it doesn't have to apply IMO rules, set its own, and charge fee for services, which is what they're doing. There are five straits that are wider than 24 miles, so we would call them international straits, that almost no ship other than Russian ships have passed through without permission. The last time we tried to pass one of those was, I think, under the Johnson administration. And I believe it was a north wind, and they were informed that that would be considered an unfriendly act and met. And we didn't want to set an icebreaker to somewhere where there was going to be something armed enforcing that.
Sure.
So they do have, I mean, I would argue against it, but they do have the possibility of arguing historic waters in a way that's more valid, I think, than China's claims to the south.
Thank
you. But for most of the part, they argue one Article 154 is their basis right now for regulating that passage.
Okay.
And until the IMO comes up with a set of rules that Russia will sign on to, would be the appropriate way to do it. That's going to be the way it runs.
Okay. Great answer. Great answer.
Important clarification.
Yeah.
Question, sir, right in front. We've got a microphone here for you.
My point is really looking at the kind of data you're using to develop policy. And I think that we're losing out on the data that we're being given to look at. And I say that, let's go back a few years. And would we have said then that there would be an 8-degree increase in temperature now? We'd probably say, well, 10 years, 15 years from now. But we have historical data that show that the temperature can go up twice that amount in 3 years. And that's happened a dozen times over the last 100,000 years. But people aren't looking at that kind of data. You can look at it, you can look it up. There's a book called 2 Mile Time Machine by Richard Alley. Now Richard, he's one of the greatest minds, I think, in terms of glaciology. And yet he doesn't want to make waves with that kind of data. So he's keeping quiet about it. And you look at the permafrost and how much carbon is there and how quickly it can go up into the atmosphere. Well, Ted Shure, who's one of the top scientists in this area, has really underplayed the role that that could play in pushing the climate up, the temperature up, very rapidly, very fast. And I think when you get having your meetings and looking at what kind of policy you're going to have, what are you looking at in 5 years from now? You mentioned, you know, 10 years from now and further down the road. What are the possibilities? And let's say what I'm saying is maybe 20% possible.
Yeah, that's right.
That's a big percentage.
Yeah.
So looking at the data rather than some of the conclusions that people are talking to the public about may be more important, that someone needs to delve in and look at the realities of the circumstances that we have and the potential for a much, much faster rise in temperature and much more severe conditions in the Arctic.
Yep.
And I mentioned one of them is methane hydrate.
Yeah.
You know, and you're doing all this drilling, well, that's going to upset the methane hydrates, and the ocean is getting a lot warmer, and suddenly someone might be releasing a huge amount of methane, and then you have all these parties that are agreeing to this and that. Well, then the fingers are going to start getting pointed at
it's a great point. There's these unknown feedback loops. There's these unknown things, and you know, frankly, so much of why people are talking about the Arctic now was this unpredicted drop in sea ice back in 2007. It was these are natural processes that we don't fully understand, and we don't, and it's very difficult to predict the future. And that's why ASP and others, we've argued for kind of this risk management approach on climate change writ large, and the fact that we do need better data, we do need better science, we need better predictive capability, and these sorts of things, you know, part of a big part of mitigation, reducing emissions, is about reducing those extreme long tail risks, those things at the very end that we just don't know what's going to happen, and you know, it's almost like this idea that we go to IPCC measures as, you know, that's gospel and that's what's going to happen is certainly not always the case. And we have to be aware of these. And even if it's not the median prediction, you have to prepare for the worst. So,
yeah, but, you know, Andrew, what we do know is last year was the hottest year on record.
That's right.
And the hottest year on record before that was the year before.
Yeah.
And the hottest decade we've ever had was the last 10 years. So to get to your point, the sad part is, and not to denigrate anybody on Capitol Hill, it's the not in my backyard syndrome. Hey, it's not affecting me, so who cares? Well, you're going to care if it all melts and your sea level rises 6 feet.
Yeah.
You're really going to care then.
I think one part of this is linear. Yeah. Are we looking at a linear progression,
that's
or
right,
are we looking at a potential phase change?
Yeah.
And the IPCC even has that in their report.
I agree more. I think we've got time for one quick one.
All the way in the back.
Yeah, Ray in the back. Yeah.
I'm Ray Arnato, retired State Department, former chair of the Arctic Council. We've talked about transit in the northern passage. What about the Bering Straits? And maybe that's to you, General. Is that ISAB going to cover that? But we're going to have a lot of increase in traffic in the Bering Straits, which is pretty.
You know,
it's not small, but, you know, it's congested. So have we talked to the Russians, or are we talking to the Russians about
That's one example of great cooperation between the United States and Russia is the Coast Guard Forum, and they work together daily. And I think Seth mentioned that there is a structure there where the Coast Guards deal, like I said, daily between us and the Russians all the time. And so there's great cooperation there, and that's kind of a nice model. If we could use it for the rest of the Arctic, it would be ideal. There are some complications on UNCLOS and to who owns waters, but that's not with Russia, it's more with Canada. But I think that there's more of a good example there of what's going on. The sad part is when you're talking ice and the Arctic environment, we have no ships. I mean, we've got one icebreaker that's functional, one. Took us 30 years to budget for a new one, and that's not coming for another 10 years. So to go back to the Capitol Hill side of the house, you know, we've got laws on the books that we cannot buy a foreign-built icebreaker. If it's going to be used in the United States military, it's going to be built in the United States. The Finns will build you an icebreaker for $400 million, maybe less. The one we've just budgeted for is ours. It's $1 billion. Yeah. But we're not there yet. But if something catastrophic happens up in the Arctic, you can bet we'll buy somebody's pretty quick.
Yeah.
Maybe I'm wrong, but.
Well, thank you all, and join me in giving a hand to our panelists.
Thank you, guys.